Healing can happen when people share their stories. Welcome to Trauma, Trial, and Transformation. Discover true stories from those who were called to sit in the witness chair. Experience their journey through the legal process and beyond. This podcast brings to light the trauma and stress caused by testifying under oath and offers resources by talking with witnesses, key litigators, and mental wellness professionals to assist with different approaches one can utilize to prepare to take the stand and how to heal after the encounter. And now, here's your host, Juliette Huck.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to Trauma, Trial, Transformation on a beautiful, rainy, wintry day in Los Angeles. I know we get to say that very often, but news is talking about a ton of rain and fear. I get all the calls from the Midwest and the East. Are we floating into the ocean? But no, we're not. We're all doing pretty well today. So, you know, I've always wondered, you know, how you kind of sit next to somebody and think you know them, or you might think that, you know, you never even really ask what their story is. Well, have you ever known somebody in your life that's actually closer in your life and not know their story? Well, today's one of those days for me. I was talking to a friend of my sister's when I was in Phoenix recently, and I've met her multiple times, and, you know, we've chatted about jewelry and meditation and holistic, you know, practices and things, but I never knew her full story until this last meeting. So I was like, oh my gosh, how did I miss this? And I think we all do in some level. We don't really sit down and listen. So today's about listening. So my guest, she grew up in Redondo Beach, California in the 70s and the 80s. What a great time in life. She has a bachelor's degree in business and graduated summa cum laude from Western International University. Today, she's the director of the workforce management in the PBM industry. I'm going to let her talk a little bit about that. And she has also mentored those at her workplace for risk employees that are kind of at the edge of their job. And especially with what she's gone through, she's, I'm sure, an amazing mentor. So today I want to welcome Lori Miller. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, we all had our days, younger days, partying, being introduced to things we, you know, all of our parents never wanted us to be introduced to. And you talk about, you know, when I met you, and I think we all knew this kind of about each other, just, you know, our short history. But, you know, how did you actually get caught up in, you know, the drugs, alcohol? You know, was it just in your face, or how did that start in your life?
Yeah, so I went to high school in the late 70s, and I remember as a freshman being turned onto pot, smoking pot with a gal that I played volleyball with. She was a junior. And we were going to a football game and we met before. We had beers and we smoked pot. And, you know, the partying in the 70s at the beach was just something that, you know, kids did and just kind of grew from there and, you know, met other like-minded students and, you know, became good friends and, you know, partied with them quite a bit.
Right. So something that I think a lot of us have gone through that started what we would think would be innocently, right, at some level. And then it sounds like you really moved into harder drugs than becoming an addict to crystal meth, which led you down a really hard, tough path, though. So how did that move from socializing with your friends to this harder core? Do you know that now?
Yeah. So in high school, I experimented with cocaine, acid, mushrooms, speed, heroin, you know, all kinds of, you know, gamut of drugs, if you will. And then in the 80s, I was in college and I met some, again, like-minded women who I played sports. I played volleyball in college and they could drink like me. And we drank to get drunk. We played the drinking games, you know, and then we also did cocaine. And the drinking to get drunk like that over years took its toll. And I became, you know, a binge drinker and, you know, drank for like 2 days. and it just kept building and building and building. And then, of course, well, in the 80s, I also did a lot of cocaine, like daily. And so again, it just, over time, it just kept building up and up. And then, you know, I was introduced to crack cocaine and I started doing that. And, you know, then into the 90s, I think you may want to ask me another question about the 90s, or, you know, I think I'll stop there and I'll let you kind of progress the story.
Okay. Well, you're going to lead me right into that actually, because you ended up being homeless, right?
I did.
Was that in the 90s?
Yeah. At the end of the 80s, I ended up being homeless, and my mom and dad lived in Arizona. So I called them and did a, in the program, we call it a geographical. And so I moved to Arizona in 1990 and I was homeless at the time, moved in with my dad, and kept partying, kept drinking. And then I got into crystal meth, and then I did end up being homeless for almost a year in Arizona toward the end of my, you know, using, if you will, in Arizona.
Yeah. So on top of this, and I mean, that's a lot to swallow right there already. But on top of this, you also had been arrested multiple times. Is that in the same time period?
Yeah. So I started using crystal meth, and then I started IV using crystal meth. So I, you know, again, it just kept escalating. And I was arrested for shoplifting was the first one. Actually, I've had a DUI. I've had two DUIs as well. And then I decided to quit my job and become a drug dealer as a career.
Wow.
Yeah. And that just led to, you know, one mishap after another, because, you know, you're running around with pretty unsavory people. And then I lost my home. I ended up getting broken into and they stole all my money, so I couldn't pay my rent. And that's when I became homeless. And and so, and during that time, I ended up with a stolen credit card and used it and got arrested for forgery of a credit card. Yeah. And so that's, it's kind of interesting to watch the timeline and the escalation and how it really led to the bottom.
Well, and the moment of what you described is going in the back door of the courthouse versus going in the front door. I thought that was just such a interesting way for you as we were speaking about your story. And how many multiple times, right? Arrested 6 or 7 times, and then one of them when you got the felony. So can you tell me what it was like the time you really knew you were going into court and you weren't sure if you're coming out, like you're going straight to jail, or like what was that? What was that moment like for you when you were staying there? Were you just like shugging it off because you'd been there multiple times, or what was your feeling that at that moment?
So when I was arrested for my felony, my dad posted bond. And so I was, you know, I pled out and was released on probation, and I immediately absconded. That is when I immediately absconded. And that's when I was on the run for quite some time. That's when I also was racking up some more misdemeanors under an alias. And after I was released on a grand theft auto charge that they actually reduced to a misdemeanor crime, I was out for 3 days and I was in my car because I was homeless, and the police rolled up on me and I, you know, gave them my alias and, you know, like I had for a year. Well, the NCIC database had caught up from the time that I was in county. And they, you know, handcuffed me. And at that point, I went into processing, and my booking slip, it was 3 pages. And I remember sitting there going, you know, holy moly, this is serious. But I also was at peace. I don't know, you know, something came over me that, you know, this is over, you know, this is finally, you know, cause I was on the run, always running away from cops and, you know, on the street. And I'll tell you, being homeless in Arizona in the summertime is brutal.
Oh,
absolutely brutal.
Oh.
It's so unforgiving. It's horrible. So anyway, that was when I was, you know, faced with a lot of charges, a lot of, you know, court time, a lot of jail time at that point.
So give me kind of that feeling in court, knowing that you're not in control anymore, right? You'd been in control. You've been doing what you want to do, how you want to do it. What was the moment of like standing in front of the judge and just like saying, okay, this is not, I'm not in control. How did that feel?
Yeah, it's interesting because the county jail system, you know, very cold, you know, the holding cell that they put you in downtown Phoenix is an old morgue. It's in a basement. They call it the dungeon, and it's just cold and concrete, and they turn out the lights. So it's pitch dark, you know, cause you have to get there at like 3 a.m. So you're really not in control, like from, you know, the time you're in custody. And the one time what I did is I did go back to court about my probation violation, and I got probation again. And I knew that that wasn't going to work for me. I had every plan in the world to go back out and use, and I would have absconded again. So I wrote the judge and I told her that I wanted to renege, you know, on the probation and take the felony charge and the prison time. And I'll never forget standing in front of that judge when she was getting ready to, you know, make her ruling or her decision. I was shaking like a leaf, like I've never shaken. It was an out of body experience because, you know, my hands, my life was in this woman's hands. Right.
Right.
And yeah, so that was the time that, you know, I just, it was in front of her and that was it.
And so at that point in time, you realized, okay, this was your way out in a way, or maybe your way in a way versus out. Like you can start to see this because this person's is going to be in control. She's going to make your decision, life decision at this point, you know, pretty much where things are going. Was that something that you look back on it now, probably not thinking about it at the time? Were you grateful for that moment?
You know, it was a result of me pretty much asking for that. So I knew I was headed to DOC, you know, state prison. And again, I still had every intention of using again, of going back out on the streets and doing the same thing I was doing. So it was a relief in that moment more than it, like, kind of like, okay, good. I'm not going to have to be on probation for 3 years. Cause that was always hanging over me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That at that point, you know, looking back on it, it was more of kind of a step that I was unaware of that kind of drove me to what happened while I was incarcerated and things like that. Yeah.
Right. So just a little bit more about like the court system and stuff. Do you feel like it was, looking back on it now, do you feel like it was fair?
I do. I mean, I committed the crimes and I did plead down, you know, plead out. And so I was able to drop a lot of the charges down, you know, a grade or, you know, but yeah, I honestly, it wasn't anything that I was mistreated or felt like the sentences were too harsh or anything like that. It was kind of like I did the crime. Now I'm going to do the, you know, take the punishment basically.
Time.
Yeah.
You're going to do the time.
Yeah.
You're going to do the crime. Yeah. Right.
Totally.
How many times were you in front of a judge?
8 different times.
8 times.
Yeah. Yeah. Or actually there's pretrial. There's so more than that. It was like 3 or 4 times per charge. Yeah. Cause you know, so it, 8 charges. Well, the one that the probation violation that brought me back, but yeah, multiple times. Yeah. Over 20.
Right.
In front of a judge.
I was going to say the multiple times for each arrest. So did it feel more comfortable for you after a while? Was it still just as scary? Like, did you shove it off at times?
It felt more comfortable. Yeah, it felt more comfortable. You get used to the waiting because that's all you do is you lay in a freezing, you know, holding cell, waiting. And for hours. And you just get, you get used to that. It's a mindset. And then also in front of the judges, it's, you're always nervous in front of a judge, at least I am, because, you know, they're kind of powerful people.
Yep, authority.
Intimidating, I guess, is the better word. But I got used to, like, what to expect, right? Like, the process and, you know, how to plead not guilty and all of that.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of people's nervousness is because they've never been in that situation.
Yeah.
And then they don't know what to expect. And then they have to be either as a witness or testifying in front of somebody.
I'll tell you one thing that I got used to, and that was talking to the police, the interviewers, the investigators, the prosecutors. I got really used to like telling them I'm not talking to you because, you know, I just learned to shut my mouth, you know, at the beginning, you know, you're trying to talk your way out of it, but you quickly learn that that's not going to work. So you know, I learned how to, you know, navigate my way through the accusing side, if you will, the prosecuting side, mm-hmm. and, you know, kind of save myself a bit with that.
Did you have a public defender?
I did.
You did. Yeah. And that was the same person or multiple times, different ones?
Multiple times. Yeah.
Yeah. So did they prep you at all? Or they just walked you in and told you what was going to happen? I mean, because you didn't really testify or anything, right?
Yeah. The plea, like they usually, you know, they would come in with a paperwork plea and, you know, read it to me, make sure that I understood it and things like that. Not really prep. Not really. Just, you know, you meet them basically when you walk into court, you know, they're at the table and like, I am John or, you know, whatever. It's, you don't get much.
Wow.
Yeah. You don't get much of, you know, a heads up or anything like that.
Wow. That's pretty quick. And
yeah.
To not even know who's representing you in that sense. But so obviously that's not where you are today. Thank God. And I know this other person, not that I wouldn't have been there to you knowing that person, but again, this was such an eye-opening thing for me. I really had no idea that was your history because I know you as today. So what juncture did you tell yourself, you know, I don't want to do this anymore? Like, where were you and what came over you?
I know the exact moment. I'll never forget it. I was in a maximum security prison in Perryville, Arizona. It was in the middle of a giant dust storm. One of those haboobs that we get here, just at very, you know, intense. And I remember looking out the door or the window on the cell door. They're, you know, they're only 4 inches wide. And I was looking out on the yard and it was just orange. And I remember looking across the yard, there was a guard at one of the gates. And I remember seeing him standing there, you know, with just getting battered by the wind and the dust. And looking at the, you know, maximum security prisons are extremely intimidating. You know, that's just fences for days, tall fences for days, razor wire everywhere. They have the multiple gates that, you know, you have to go through and they have to shut them and you go through another one and the back one shuts. And he's standing there and waiting for one of them to open by himself because we are on lockdown. And I remember thinking to myself, maybe I don't want to use again. And that was like the tiny spark, the fleeting thought that opened up my mind to accept what was coming down the road in my life.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. How long were you in that maximum security place?
6 months.
6 months. So was this timing in the 6 months? Was it early on, late that you had this epiphany?
Yeah, I was clean for about 4 months, like clean enough to have a clear head to actually mm-hmm. think about that. And that was the first time I'd ever thought of that in my adult life. Cause partying was just what we did. And
right. Yeah.
And so it was probably about 4 months, 3.5, 4 months into it, where again, I had a clear enough head to actually have that kind of a thought.
Have a thought that they could come through like that. So what happened after your 6 months? Like, what was your next step to start getting on your path where you are the person I know today?
Yeah. So I was released into a halfway house and my dad paid for 2 weeks. And then he said, kid, you're on your own, which was the best thing he could have ever done for me. You know, the tough love. It's not an easy decision, mm-hmm. but I thanked him, you know, after that. And the halfway house had a requirement of 5 AA meetings a week. And then they also had house meetings. Mm-hmm. And I was released on like a Wednesday and I palled up with a gal that had a truck and we went to a speaker meeting on a Friday night. And I will never forget that meeting either. And that another, you know, turning point in my life. Walked in, everybody smiling, laughing, friendly. They all had nice clothes on. They were driving nice cars. You know, it's a dingy little room, but it was probably the brightest thing I'd ever seen. Right. And, right. I remember looking at the 12 steps and 12 principles on the wall and thinking to myself, I can do this. It's such a simple program. It really is. And if you just, you know, don't overthink it and just, it just really is. And I just remember seeing how simple this was. And I was like, I can do this. And I've never looked back. I have not relapsed. I have not, yeah.
So really the 4 months getting you clean that you could think, number one, and then the support system through AA and everything else really got you. So talk about your transformation. Like what, how did you stay on it? How did you stay with it? Like, talk a little bit about your journey now from the transformation side of this.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was released right into the middle of, I call it my playground, right where I used, right where all my friends were. And it's interesting because I took the simplicity of AA, seriously. And they recommend a meeting a day for a year. And I did a meeting a day for 2 years, first 2 years of my sobriety. And on the weekends, we would do multiple. I did NA and AA, but I really took it seriously and studied the material and, participated in, big book readings. And also I did sponsor a few people. I also got a sponsor. But and then also, put that life behind me. I really made a conscious effort to make healthy choices, hang out with healthy people, and start drawing boundaries around, who I am and who I want in my life. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of the transformation.
Well, that is some strength because, I know with myself, it's like, having the willpower. That's what I've always said to people, that it's having the will to change. It's having the will to want to make something truly different. That's not always easy, right?
Yeah. I mean, the rock bottom, I had driven my life into the ground and knew that I did not belong there. And one thing that I did early in sobriety too, is I made a decision to make a serious commitment to my work ethic and got a job. And actually that job was the beginning of where I promoted up until where I am today.
Wow.
And that really was, I knew that was a critical piece of me building my life to where I needed it to be or where I wanted it to be. And, with the financial piece of it. And so that mm-hmm. was that my sobriety, my recovery and my work ethic were, two cornerstones of my recovery.
That's absolutely amazing. Can you explain for people that are listening that may not understand the difference between AA and NA?
Yeah, AA is Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's the big book and it's the original big book from the 40s and 50s with Dr. Bob and it's all the original, text and everything like that. And NA is Narcotics Anonymous. It's the same principles, but it's got different texts and it's more geared towards addiction than alcoholism. And I was both. So that's why I did both.
Well, that's great to know that both of those are out there. I don't know if a lot of people know that NA is even out there. Did you ever do any like meditation or anything like that in jail? Or was that so far from your mind that you didn't even think about stuff like that? Like, did you ever have any spiritual connection?
So it's funny you ask. When I was in jail, I actually met up with somebody that I was friends with on the street and we were good friends. And we were both in, right? And she was a Christian and, religious. And I wasn't. And we would do Bible study. There was also two other gals. So there were four of us. Wow. And we would do Bible study like every, like three nights a week. And I remember asking her, what is faith? Like, cause I was not religious at all. I'm still not really religious. I'm mm-hmm. more spiritual. And she was like, you just believe, very matter of fact. And I remember that night I had court the next day and I did a little, they call it a foxhole prayer where it's like, please God, make the judge, rule in favor, favorably. And it was just a little prayer that actually did kind of, instead of being turned away from God, it turned me towards God. And it started building my spiritual path. Yeah, meditation, not in jail, but, you know, I did read, I had a Bible called Free on the Inside and, you know, again, studied it with my friend. And, but yeah, meditation is more that I do, you know, more recently or currently.
Yeah. So would you say that a spiritual component through that process was part of your transformation?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Very interesting. So, you know, we're going to wrap up here in a few minutes, but I really love asking this question. Do you think healing's a choice?
Healing, do I think healing is a choice? I do. But you have to be ready and willing to do it. You know, there has to be some willingness to change. And like I said, I drove my life into the ground and I knew that I didn't belong there. I didn't know how to get out of it, but you know, I ended up, you know, using recovery to do it. But it absolutely, healing is absolutely a choice.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it's, everybody's got a very interesting answer to that. And, you know, I ask everybody that, you know, the question about healing is a choice, but this year I also want to ask if you can take your journey or your transformation and put one word to it. Could you do that?
Wow, that's a stumper. I want to say evolving.
Awesome.
Because my life has just completely evolved from, you know, through the stages that we've talked about, and it continues to evolve.
Well, your evolution is quite impressive. I have to tell you that. That's been, I'm hoping that others out there understand that stand in a courtroom and you can also change your life, right? And that's the whole point of this podcast. So, Lori, I really want to thank you. I'm really grateful for you. I said, I had no idea that this was your story, like story. I have only known a little tiny piece of your evolution. So I'm grateful that you've shared this with us today and our audience. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. A great discussion. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, well, everyone, you know, just let's remember, you never know someone's story, even if you know them, without asking. So ask. Let's listen. Thanks for joining me. And don't forget, go out and spread some love. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Trauma, Trial, and Transformation. If you want to share your experience as a witness, please forward your information to info@juliethuck.com. For more information on Juliet's 30-year career in the courtroom, visit us at juliethuck.com. There you can find her books, The Equation of Persuasion and 50 Ways to Get Your Way, available on Amazon. Remember to follow and subscribe to Trauma, Trial, and Transformation wherever you listen to podcasts.